You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Welcome to a special edition of Game Changers Clinical Conversations, and it's special because you don't have to listen to me for a week, which I'm sure many people are happy about. No, we have a special guest, and I'm very excited about this, we felt like the best way to deliver this was just to basically let this special guest kind of do the entire podcast without extra time taken up by me asking questions. So this week we're going to change things up a little bit. Kathy Schott from the CE Impact team will be joining the podcast today with Dr. Vibhuti Arya. Dr. Arya is an associate clinical professor at St. John's College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences and serves as an advisor to the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And one can only imagine what her job has been like in the last 3 months. Dr. Arya examines public health programs and policies through the lens of equity, applying social justice principles and frameworks to help reduce inequalities of care. She's given some TED Talks, and I'll bet you we can probably put some of the links to the TED Talks in the show notes as well, on structural racism, and she'll be talking with the CE Impact team about structural racism as a healthcare emergency, obviously something that has dominated the news in the last several weeks and something we should all be listening to. So again, I welcome Dr. Arya and look forward to her excellent presentation.
Thank you so much for that intro, Jeff. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining us today on this special episode. I'm Kathy Schott, a member of the CE Impact team, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Vibhuti Arya. As Jeff shared, Dr. Arya is a faculty member at St. John's College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Queens, New York, and she also serves as an advisor to the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Welcome, Dr. Arya. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start by having you share just a little bit about your own professional journey, if you would. What led you to your work in the area of health equity, and what kind of work are you engaged in currently?
Thank you. So I have been actually engaged with the space of sort of social justice and activism before I fully immersed myself in pharmacy. So I sort of bring together my backgrounds with theater, namely community theater, to actually use the arts to address the topics of a lot of social justice issues that have come up in our society. So in carrying that social justice sort of lens forward, I always have thought about social determinants and kind of structural racism in a way that is very palpable. So I've had lots of family and friends and personally impacted by many of the social injustices that have led to a lot of negative impact on health. And so certainly it was a personal cause, but societally is looking at it. Mostly I've been serving in medically underserved communities, and certainly communities of color and those who are marginalized experience racism and social determinants of health in a very palpable sort of visceral way. So it's not new to me, but I did have a very intentional lens with which to practice pharmacy so that it would be meaningful to serve these communities and bring that perspective and that narrative forward, because oftentimes those perspectives and narratives are missing. Oftentimes there are many dominant narratives that sort of take over and we don't really question them. We just assume or, you know, are afraid to, for whatever reason, challenge the status quo. So it's been a long journey and a personal journey. And within that activism space, there has been a lot of movement that I'm hopeful and encouraged by seeing nowadays, that many people have been working towards. So it's been really, you know, impactful for my own life, but also certainly in the communities that I've served in. And from the public policy angle, this has been really important because most of our policies and most of our data that shape those policies, again, you need to bring that health equity lens so that people can really understand the full picture of what's happening and not assumptions and, you know, even in research and not having enough data or assuming things that how we're practicing medicine and access to healthcare has been a huge issue. So right now with the New York City Health Department, I'm in this space. I've been everywhere from cardiovascular health and chronic disease to health information technology, correctional health, and now in emergency preparedness. And again, you know, couldn't be more apt timing, I suppose, but really thinking about standards of care, crisis standards of care, thinking about how clinicians are called to make judgments and decisions in very sort of keenly emergent situations that call for a sense of anxiety and decision-making on the spot. Where so much of judgment could be clouded by their own implicit biases, for example. And so really thinking about how we shape those clinical treatment protocols and decision-making to provide the lens of equity so we're not brushing aside narratives or making more assumptions than that could actually be really harmful for many communities. So that's where I'm at right now. And one of the most rewarding things has been that as a faculty member and a person who practices public health as a pharmacist, I get to share that with my students. And we critically examine historical and current policies, public policies, and public health programs to question sort of intention versus impact. You know, what was the intent? Are they racially explicit? Is it implicit? Why are communities of color and specifically Black Americans, for example, in certain disease states, impacted so negatively and disproportionately? And so I think that it really opens up this understanding of, again, utilizing data and policy to shape what access to care potentially could look like and how do we as pharmacists use our privilege to help engage with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a journey. And I'd love to be a student in your class. What a good opportunity, an important opportunity for them. So thanks for sharing that. I'm sure that we're not the only folks who have been reaching out to you for your perspective. So I'm really glad that you are willing to take some time with us. Talk a little bit about the concepts. You talked a little bit about this already, but the concept of social determinants of health and the concept of racism. I'm not sure many people always recognize the way in which those two concepts are uniquely separate, but also related, than say maybe when we talk about poverty as a social determinant of health.
Sure. So social determinants of health essentially are everything about us, where we eat, live, work, play, commute, et cetera, the physical surroundings, the factors that we come into interaction with that ultimately impact our health. So when we talk about clinical care, really as pharmacists, when we're focusing so much on how students are taught to give care, it's about 20%, right, impact that actually that makes it to the patient. But really when we think about social determinants, this is more than half, about 60%, is all around built environments where people have access to food, where they have access to even their commuting to work and how long that takes, what stressors there are. And all of these factors impact health outcomes for a patient, for any person, right? So you can have the best treatment for a certain disease state, but if it's not accessible, it's a moot point. And so social determinants of health are really exactly calling to light that there are socially determined factors that impact health outcomes. And the reason that racism is intricately tied, racism is actually a root cause of social determinants of health, because there are a lot of different, again, structural policies and ways in which every part of society has been sort of shaped is to essentially disproportionately impact so many communities and specifically Black Americans. And so racism is a root cause of why those social determinants of health exist in the first place. So we're talking about everything from housing segregation, where you live, everything from food insecurity, what options you have. You know, how many times have we told our patients to make better choices, or, you know, the eating and eating habits and the access to food is really important, but we don't take into account that they may or may not have access to good things, right? So if it's fast food versus grocery stores versus bodegas and what they carry, what does all that mean? And so it's really taking a wholesome approach on an individual and recognizing that there are factors beyond their individual choice and reach that shape the way that they interact with their healthcare system and also the way that their bodies react and what conditions they may end up kind of being predisposed to or not because of these social elements. And so traditionally, I think that certainly poverty is the case. It has a very real impact. From a very early point, if a child is hungry, it's hard to pay attention. How many of us get hangry, right? Or we have, you know, we need meals and we need proper nutrition. hydration. And so how can we expect children who don't have access to good food to show up and learn and retain information in their school environments without really addressing food, for example? Right. And so a lot of times the conversation has been so limited because we hide behind words such as poverty, such as, you know, more safe words rather than really talking about racism as a root cause. I remember doing this seminar for students, for graduate students, and, you know, one of the things that I said, you know, if you close your eyes and I ask you to imagine this woman who's got, you know, a subsidy card and who's buying sort of, you know, the equivalent of food stamps in a grocery store, what do you see? And, you know, a couple of people were like, poverty. I'm like, yeah, well, what do you see? And one of the ways, you know, there was a white male student who said, you know, I can't say that. And I said, can't say what? And he said, a black person. And what was so touching about that and transformational in that dialogue was that people are even afraid to name these things and to say, right, that yes, I understand that more than half the people in the United States who are on government subsidies are actually white, but the picture that has been painted through such dominant narratives that are false in nature, for example, through media or the things that are shifted and skewed, that we are not realizing that unless we have those conversations, we cannot even begin to start dismantling and understanding how we can use our privilege to talk about racism in a very palpable way where we can actually impact the lives of people. And so the point of understanding and bringing this together is to add the narratives and the perspectives there. You know, when I teach my students about data, I tell them these are people behind these data, right? So a life expectancy that's shortened by 20 years is not just a number. It is somebody's grandfather or grandmother or parent or brother or sister or son or daughter missing from critical milestones in their lives, that these are stories of people and not just numbers for us to focus on and hide behind these concepts, right? It's super easy to be very impersonal when we're talking about these concepts. It's not just a concept. And so the idea here is to acknowledge and to recognize that this is a very deep issue. We certainly are not going to solve it in a day, or many years for that matter. But unless we start having some real conversations and acknowledging the facts and the system for what it is, we certainly would not be in a place to serve our patients in that system where we are called to be healthcare providers, where we are called to be caretakers and understand that patient as a whole, not just as a disease state. And so that's what we're really talking about. The crux of the matter is in recognizing that the system exists and it disproportionately impacts people. And we need to use our privilege and use our voice to advocate for reform there.
So much to think about there. I want to get back to some of the things you were saying about conversation and having difficult conversation. But before we do that, talk a little bit about maybe the unique opportunity we have here, and it sounds odd to say it that way, but with COVID-19 and how that has really maybe shown a spotlight on the issue of race and racism in healthcare. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I think the one thing is that this time of sort of this forced quarantine or lockdown, wherever people might be in their jurisdictions geographically, has certainly given us time to pause and think about this work. I think that, you know, we say that whatever we don't struggle with is invisible to us. So for many people, this was invisible for a long time. And now with the convergence of social media, body cams, voices that are not afraid to be amplified and be loud, I think that we have a unique opportunity because people are at home. For those who have the privilege to work from home or be at home, it's giving us time to pause. And largely the majority, right? Like, I mean, these protests and a lot of social justice issues are no new thing. It's certainly not new. These books and readings and conversations are not new in certain circles. But I think what was really encouraging is that it's the first time I've seen so many white people at a protest, for example, or people speaking up and really calling themselves and hurting to be allies. And I think that's encouraging and you need that. I think where the conversations are important is that, again, if we all kind of went back to work and fell back into those structures where we have to report to a boss and see somebody and keep it together and have decorum and all of that kind of stuff. You know, this might have been just another time of a news story that would have been unfortunate, but not actionable in a way. And I think that what the pandemic has done is allowed so many to take pause and really have those difficult conversations with their families, with their friends, and just sheer magnitude of just seeing what's happening. You know, so I think that the time, although not under the best circumstances, has had a silver lining where it has produced this this kind of time for reflection. And, you know, it's also been interesting because as folks sort of were thinking about, you know, it's so hard to be home or in lockdown or in quarantine, you know, I remember reminding so many that, look, we are so privileged that you don't have to, you know, get laid off right away. You still have a job. You still have a roof over your head. You can get food delivery, right? And so one of the ways in which the pandemic also, I think, calls us to advocate for reform on so many levels is even the idea about essential workers, right? People who are out in the community. I mean, the U.S. is, you know, traditionally an individual country, right? It's about the person, the individual. And in this pandemic, we've had to think communally. And I think many people are not used to doing that. So I, you know, we used to hear things from, well, I'm okay. I can walk out. I don't, you know, I don't feel like I'm at risk. And we have to remind folks, this is not about your individual risk. It's about other people. So the essential workers who are out there serving in many capacities, not just healthcare, people who are delivering food, people who are delivering groceries, people, mail carriers, packages, et cetera. And that we are doing this also for them because we don't want them to be exposed because they're still the breadwinners or the people who have to have, you know, hourly wages or jobs that require them to step out of the comfort of their home and away from their families. And so I think that the idea about the essential workers, you know, we were talking with some friends about the 7 p.m. clapping, you know, it has a certain feel good kind of bring the community together to really talk about healthcare professionals and essential workers coming together to serve, right, people. But we can take that one step further and say, let's not stop at the clapping, right? Let's actually advocate so that the essential workers who we deem essential do not have essential benefits. They don't have healthcare. They don't have basic necessities that all of us get to sit here and enjoy in our privilege. And I think that's another opportunity that the pandemic has given us, not only just for understanding structural racism, but also thinking about, you know, who are the communities who are essential workers, right? So healthcare workers, many of them do have healthcare and are protected and have these certain privileges, I would still say, than compared to, for example, delivery workers, right? Or people who are carrying our mail and exposed to things outside of their choice. And so I think that it has helped us understand how we can reflect better during this time to rally together, to say, I'm with you. How can I be of service to you? And I think it's confusing, right? Because there are a lot of people feeling many different ways. There are folks who, you know, are feeling that it's disingenuous, that this is just a media post and it's not going to last long. And we're trying and hoping that we don't stay in that space of cynicism, but move and say, you know, like Hamilton, right? Moment to a movement. And how do we sustain this change? And I think that it is, a lot of people are coming together to recognize that and to hold each other accountable for that, to make sure that it is sustainable and to make sure that we do petition our legislators, that we do go out and vote, right? A lot of young people kind of finding that power again to vote and have a voice. So so all this to say that I think the silver lining is that it has allowed us to reflect, to see what may have been invisible to so many before, and to understand in a very tangible way how they can deepen their own understanding and their own blind spots, but also use their privilege to advocate for reform and change in so many places where the need has been for so long, but hopefully now can actually come to fruition.
Yeah. We have, I've been lucky enough to have two of my adult children home this summer, and we've come to call the summer of discourse, because I think every evening just about ends in conversation on the patio or the deck about all that's happening in our world. And it's been enlightening for me to have the perspective of younger folks talking, you know, talking through some of these things. And you know, just even that much conversation, I think has, you know, helped me grow personally. So I can see how more conversation is so important. But Beauty, talk a little bit about, you know, as pharmacists, you know, what specifically, what are some tangible things that as pharmacists we can do to use that privilege that you're talking about to really, you know, have a lasting effect on, you know, maybe even our own pharmacy teams, and then how we empower our pharmacy teams to have an impact on our patients and you know, others in our community as well.
Sure. I think there are a lot of different ways, you know, ranging from the individual perspective to the systems approach. So certainly on the individual level, I think deepening our own understanding and just listening, frankly, to, you know, people as they're talking, specifically communities of color, there's this want to, especially as healthcare professionals, to fix everything, right, and to have an answer or to help. And I call my students to kind of revisit their motivation behind a lot of their career aspirations or helping people and fixing the issues. And there's an author, Rachel Naomi Remen, who wrote Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessings, who does this piece on talking about, she's an oncologist, and talks about helping assumes that somebody's weak, fixing assumes that somebody's broken. And those two are the work of the ego, right? Because we want something in return, so to speak, or to feel heroic. Whereas serving is the work of the spirit. And one of the ways in which we can really truly understand that is we're not here to help and fix the problem in that traditional sense. We're here to reform. We're here to think about what the problem even is, because there are a lot of assumptions in place, I think, in society, in our own, you know, we all have blind spots. We all have implicit biases. That's the nature of who we are, and that's okay. We just need to understand and bring that to the consciousness so that we can kind of question and anticipate where we're coming from when we start saying something or making a decision. And I think having the humility to say, I'm sorry, or I don't know, one of the most powerful things and validating, frankly, that has been for so many of us is people just saying, look, I'm ashamed it had to come to this. I'm ashamed that and deeply sad that it took so many years and so long that now we're starting to recognize it, right? Those of us who've been working in this and our whole professional career has kind of rolled our eyes for a bit, and we're like, okay, great, you know, people recognize there's racism, great. But, and not in a, you know, I think there certainly were some anger there, but moving in a more hopeful space to recognize that, yeah, it has taken this long. And now what, right? So, but sitting in that discomfort for a little bit, because discomfort really is where growth and learning happen. We're not going to fix this issue overnight. Certainly, you know, it might take generations even. It's how we educate our children. It's how we educate and confirm and validate what beauty is. It's how we educate and confirm and validate and listen to their choice of scenarios and partners and friends and how we react to those things. It's encouraging our students to be activists and to advocate and say, speak up when you see something wrong and utilize that privilege, because there are others who may not feel okay to speak up. And so I think on a very personal level, it's examining sort of what your individual and family structures look like and how we can continue those conversations there with humility, with vulnerability, but also recognizing that there are systems at play here. So how do we, for example, in helping with co-pays, right, or serving our patients and understanding how we can make medicines more affordable. How do we understand how to bring perspectives and leadership in pharmacy from those who have a diversity of perspective, have a diverse lived experience, and, you know, who represent our patients probably more than we may, right? And so I think that part of it is understanding how to truly make it representative. I think we have to think about equity in our pipeline, right? Where are the pharmacists who are serving our communities, our universities, our students, faculty who represent our students, right? And then making sure that we have support structures in place for those people to succeed, right? For all of us in our leadership positions, in our lived experience, to not feel afraid to say, hey, I don't think that's the way that we've done it is always the greatest way, and not fear retaliation. Right. And so part of this work really engages understanding not only our own issues, but also what we're blind to. So part of privilege is what you don't see, right? That you don't have to experience. And in understanding that, you can then start having a little bit better, I think, view into what our patients go through. So when we say things, even in counseling, such as, you know, I think you just need to lose weight. Well, that might be easy for us to say, or, you know, eat healthy. How many times have we heard that, right? Exercise, go walking. You know, somebody was saying recently, just like, oh, I don't understand. Why can't you just take your kids walking? Like, well, you know, New York City is a little bit different. We don't have backyards, all of us, in the same way, and some do. And so I think there's just sort of this, again, assumed baseline understanding of what we think our patients may go through, and frankly, what we think is in their control. So when we make recommendations, when we counsel our patients, understanding what are their choices like, right? And just being open to listening. I think that's a key, is to, before we speak up, we just kind of listen and try to understand, because I don't know the answers, and I don't know what everybody else, you know, goes through or experiences. So I think that's part of it. And I think that it's critically examining some of the structures in our workplaces, wherever we are, to see, you know, who gets heard, how are they heard, and who are we serving even, right? Just if you think about a basic issue of who are we serving, and do we even ask them questions? Do we have their perspectives? Do we ask our patients how they're doing? You know, do we ask them, how is it that, you know, what's on their mind? I mean, we teach our students this, right? Chief complaint, no matter what's happening, the chief complaint is what we need to address. But when the chief complaint is so socially intricate, how do we address that? How do we just sit there and make the space for them and make the time for them to process what they're going through? How do we support them? And it may not mean sort of, again, this fixing the problem. It may not mean that we solve whatever issue is happening, but we need to embrace that lack of closure, so to speak, right? We need to embrace that discomfort. And I think it starts from listening and actively seeking those perspectives. With the caveat of saying that, look, I'm trying to learn, I'm trying to understand, but it's also okay for them not to hold that space for you, right? So which is where our work comes in, and not just relying on people of color to say, hey, can you solve this for me? Tell me what I need to read, right? So it's, and though not malintended, right, not malicious, but it does kind of put the burden back. And so I think it's just a new realm of consciousness I think folks are going to be experiencing, and, you know, and their support. We're all sort of, you know, in this together, and that we all have to do our part. So that's a really long way of saying just kind of listening and actively seeking that input and deepening our own understanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that was so helpful. I think what stood out to me there is that concept of that privilege isn't just what we experience, but also what we don't experience, and that need to listen and ask questions about things that are maybe difficult and more complex to understand than what the chief complaint on paper is. I think
right. That
was just a great way to
and it might be painful. Yeah. It might be painful to hear some of these things, mm-hmm. but you know, I guarantee that it's not as painful as those who are experiencing it. Right. So there is a sense of humility and kind of being called to step up that we just all need to participate in a very, very present way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with me and with our listeners today about this, such a critical factor that often is overlooked when we talk just in general terms about social determinants of health. So I think it's been really important to call racism and structural racism out as a root cause of that and have that conversation. So thank you very much for doing that. I want to mention to listeners that I've added a link to a TED Talk that Dr. Arya recorded some time ago, pre-COVID, of course. If you want to listen a little bit more and hear a little bit more about her story, I would encourage you to look up that link and have a listen. And then I also want to mention that over the next few weeks, the Impact is going to be offering some additional opportunities to continue the conversation. And in July and August, Dr. Arya has graciously offered to host some virtual open dialogues. For those who want to explore the existence of racism in our healthcare system and continue to help us identify ways in which we can play an active role to dismantle it, what our role and our action is there in that space. And then in September, we'll have access, learners will have access to a full CE course on this topic as well. So keep an eye on the website for more information on all of these things and for the rest of our educational opportunities as well. Dr. Arya, thanks again so much. I wish you well.
Thank you very much for having me.
So thank you, Dr. Arya, and the CE Impact team for opening up the dialogue in such a critical aspect of healthcare. Pharmacists, we all have a responsibility to do the work that we can to help with this. You know, this is something that I think physicians and nurses have often taken a lead in, but we can too, and we should too. So talking about the existence of these equities is the first step in making these issues known and coming up with solutions for them instead of just talking about them. So anyway, look forward to seeing you next week with me and my blabbering mouth next week at another regular time for Game Changers Clinical Conversations. So remember that time flies. We don't know where it's going, but the most important day is today. We'll see you next week.